My job is to investigate crimes against U.S. naval personnel.
And my job is to enforce Australian law. Which is why I don't want to get into this whole pissing contest here.
Couldn't agree more.
Great.
So let's just accept that I can piss further than you can, shall we?
This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 485 for the week of November 13th, 2023. I am Navy Chazwazer David T. Cole, and I'm here with Rear Admiral Sarah D. Bunting.
I'm a peach.
Manic Pixie double PhD Tara Ariano.
If it's about science, I know it.
And Poop Deck Alan Steppenwald.
See, it's funny because there's poop in the name.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. Joining us, he is the chief TV critic of Rolling Stone. You've heard him with us before many times. It's Alan Steppenwald.
Oh, it's so great to be back, guys, every time.
Well, we really tested it this time because we are here to talk about NCIS colon Sydney.
When this came up originally, we were going over our options for what was sort of a thin week premiere-wise.
Uh-huh.
And somebody mentioned NCIS Sydney, which I'm like, first of all, what? But then I'm like, how about Alan? How about Alan, famous for his really good reviews of like anti-heroes and prestige TV? And we get him in for this commodity television show. Mm-hmm. Let's do it. Tickles me pink.
I have history with the franchise, which we can talk about eventually. So I feel perfectly qualified for this.
Okay, I'm looking forward to it. So in NCIS Sydney, Australia's foreign minister, it's kind of equivalent to the U.S. Secretary of State, is presiding over a ceremony regarding an American nuclear submarine getting stationed at Fleet Base East in Wallabaloo. First, she gets interrupted when activists unfurl a small and tasteful Go Home Yanks banner. Then she gets interrupted when one of the sailors standing on top of the submarine falls into the bay and dies, or possibly dies and then falls into the bay. Does the investigation of his death fall into the Naval Criminal Investigation Service, since it happened while he was on the naval job? Or does it fall to the Australian Federal Police, since he died in Sydney Bay? And what actually caused the sailor's death? The series premiere aired on CBS last night. Let's do the Chen check-in. Alan, should our listeners watch NCIS Sydney?
Nah.
Sarah?
Well, they say it's better to ask forgiveness than permission. You have both of mine to not watch this. It's not good.
Dave?
But what is the name for this type of show? Because, like, if a movie is a popcorn movie, uh-huh, like, this is, like, microwave popcorn television... which has all the turn off your brainness of a popcorn movie without,
yes,
being flavorful and without real butter. It's sort of like that. So it's a no, but like, let's put it in the correct bucket.
Yeah.
For our expectations.
Of popcorn.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So let's get into why. Alan, you've been in the TV criticism game a long time. You've watched a lot of cop shows. How many times,
yes,
have you seen drama built around a jurisdictional dispute? And where does the one in this show rank? Sarah, prepare your answer because we're going to you next.
I've seen a number of jurisdictional disputes, you know, just off the top of my head. There was a whole FX show about it, The Bridge.
Right.
You know, where it's like the El Paso-Mexico border.
Sure.
That was not bad. As you say, I've been covering TV a long time. This franchise technically has outlived me because JAG was on the air the year before I started covering television. One of the very first things I wrote about as a TV critic at the Star Ledger was JAG moving to CBS.
Wow.
And sort of the format tweaks of that. And then at a certain point, they did a phony spinoff of it, NCIS, because those characters had never been part of the show before. They backdoor piloted them.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched Original Recipe NCIS for at least a couple of years, because I like Mark Harmon. And it was not great television. It was, as Dave said, kind of microwave popcorn television. But like, if you have a charismatic actor at the center of it, like Mark Harmon, and everything else is bog standard enough, sure, I will watch that, especially in, you know, in an era where there was not nearly as many things to do. This one, I mean, there's nothing there. I watched, because I'm a diligent person, a second episode of this morning.
Wow.
Just because, like, I didn't want the conversation to run dry before we wanted it to. And I mean, the second episode involves them, like, dealing with exotic animal smuggling,
yes,
or something.
Oh!
And one of the NCIS members, the British guy playing American,
uh-huh,
is threatened by a snake under a house, and it's still just super boring.
Question about the second episode. Does it end with a monkey and a basketball?
No, but there is a parrot that inadvertently learns to call the lead character dumbass.
Nice.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
I think I might be all upside down on this show now.
As it were. All down under, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Sarah, same question. Jurisdictional dispute did not keep you in the door, it sounds like.
No. And the whole two sets of fish out of the same body of water, that didn't work. I was on a job once, like 15 years ago, where I was required to like write up plot developments and on original flavor NCIS. Mm-hmm. And I think the next NCIS LA, I guess, was like kind of new at that time. And this is parental TV, which mm-hmm. is like hotel TV, but even more by numbers and like anodyne and flavorless. Like, it's not even empty calories, because that implies like something of a pleasurable eating experience. Mm-hmm. I've strayed far afield with this metaphor, so let me just get back to the point, which is this is not offensive and it's not bad. It's just a nothing. It's like the new Hawaii Five-0. My parents enjoyed that show when I was at their house. If it was time to watch that, we were watching it. And like, I retained nothing, but I also wasn't infuriated. It's just there. Mm-hmm. And if a network has a spot for that, it doesn't seem like that's something that you would waste like scheduling blocks on. But in the current sort of post/mid-strike situation, I guess this is what you're looking at. Mm-hmm. And it's not great, but I'm not infuriated. Certainly every other cop show has done whatever they're doing in this pilot mm-hmm. better. Also, TV characters, please stop calling doctors Doc. It's not cute. Just call them Doctor or by their names.
Hawaii Five-0 had Scott Kahn, you know, who is like not a great performance, but like you remembered what he was doing. And all of these people are so forgettable. Oh, I did mention a big plot point in the second episode is the lead NCIS agent is surprised that Australian people drive on the other side of the road.
Shut the fuck up. No, he's not. No.
She is. She's like, there's a whole like pissing contest between her and the main Aussie guy where like she wants to drive, but she gets in on the wrong side of the car initially. A lot of jokes
They've
about that.
They've been in a car together though.
In the pilot.
Yes.
Wow.
That's great.
Okay,
that's
maybe this is perfect. Actively bad. Excuse me.
Watching the show gives me the same vibes mm-hmm. as going to an industry conference where you're just like there and you're like, oh, what is like, it doesn't feel real. You know, you're talking to people and you're in a real building. It's a hotel, but it's also like liminal and it doesn't really feel like the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. Like that's the show. And it's something like I would imagine even like compared to NCIS America.
Uh-huh.
That it feels out of place because it has that stink of 10,000 countries making one show. Uh-huh. Oh, it's Ireland and Canada and France and South Africa and four other countries. They've all made Vikings 5, you know, and you're like, oh no, Vikings 5 and it's modern day. What? Like it has that kind of vibe where it's like, I understand the pieces of the puzzle, but this combination of things seems like it wasn't really thought out to its full extent. And I realize it's probably all to do with tax breaks or something like that.
For sure.
The only reason we got this.
Yeah, well, it wasn't going to be if not for the strike. Yeah. That's why we're getting this.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. It does have a real Pacific Blue level of.
Yes.
It feels like a syndicated action show.
And just the poor man's version of everything.
Yes.
There's a poor man's Gwyneth Paltrow. There's a poor man's Philip Seymour Hoffman. There's a poor man's Kylie Bunbury. Mm-hmm. There's a poor man's everything.
Poor man's Jim Gaffigan.
Uh-huh.
As the yes. Thank you. Yes. Kangaroo pocket.
Yeah, I mean, it has all the pieces that you're expecting to see, except both of the series leads are like loose cannons who play by their own rules. Yeah. And then like their two partners, like they forgot to give them any characteristics at all. Like mm-hmm. Cooper and Deshaun. Is that the other guy's name? The English guy who's playing American? Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. Alan Struggen. Don't know.
The
don't
female
care.
Lead is also English playing American. Yes, so it's like you're doing this whole like thing where it's trying to be this agriculture clash.
Yeah.
And you have two people who are kind of faking it to begin with. And right. obviously there's a long tradition of Brits playing Americans, some mm-hmm. of them quite well, like Damian Lewis or Hugh Laurie. But like,
right.
if you're trying for specificity, you know, get like Ed Burns or something, you know, like yeah. actually do it up.
Yep. Yes. Oh, God knows he's not doing anything else. And then there's the person that I was referring to in my intro, which is the Manic Pixie double PhD, because I know even in my limited contact with CBS procedurals, you need an all-purpose smarty. She should be a lady. If you can make her quirky, give her like a vaguely vintagey wardrobe, that's even better. And that's Bluebird Gleason is the character's name. Like,
sounds like a car wax from the 20s. Yeah, you need to know that. Give it a shine, a little bit of that blue Gleason.
Of the Kennebunkport Gleasons. Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the leads are cute enough. I don't not want them to make out, but because a show like this, they have to wait to give you anything. Like, it's going to happen in season 4 if it lasts that long. And, like, there's just, like, nothing, there's nothing sticking to me with this show.
But just
all.
Rewind to the premise, mm-hmm. whereas all these dangerous things are happening where the might of America meets the might of Australia. Oh, there's nothing tenser than American-Australian relations right now. It's the geopolitical hotbed down there. It's just like a funny premise. It would be like a show about the Canadian-American, like if they did The Bridge, but it was over like the Rainbow Bridge in Niagara Falls. You're like, well, what happened? Well, this person tripped and chipped a tooth. Uh-oh.
Yeah. I mean, the original show always, and I guess the American spinoffs always have to kind of justify, like, why are we investigating this? How many navally related people are being killed? Here, there's this added degree of convolution because it's got to be like U.S. Navy related people in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
How many of those murders do you anticipate there being in a given year?
15?
That seems like a lot.
It does seem like a lot. Yeah. It also seems like they're setting up this Xena person who like used a dating app to catfish the sailor that died or whatever. Like there's, she maybe gets away at the end. It's like, ooh, she could be their Moriarty. Like, no, she's their Boriarty at best.
Boriarty.
Like this, it's so corny and lazy. And it is, parent TV is a perfect way to put it. Sarah.
Okay.
That's who it's for.
Bad show, but. Let's give it up for the best part of the pilot episode, which is the one Australian extra whose only job was to jump in front of a windshield and angrily give the finger to whoever was inside the protest.
Uh-huh.
This guy, without having his mouth open, without saying one word, chewed all the scenery available with one gesture from his hand. He was so angry. He was so mad. I wanted to show about that guy.
Mm-hmm.
He sort of saved that hour of my life. I'm thinking back to him now. I want to know him. So you know how the Gilded Age is a TV show?
Yeah.
And that I've been calling it Opera Wars because that's all it's become now. Uh-huh. And I love it. Well, guess what happened last week on Opera Wars?
Where's Mr. Russell?
At his office. He slipped away.
Is he enjoying the opera war?
No. He'd like to know if you're going to take a box. So would I.
They said the thing! I did it!
You did it.
I don't know how we're ever going to top that, but let's try with Around the Dial. First up, Tara.
I just want to let the listener know, it really did make Dave's night.
And Dave, I have good news for you, Dave. They say opera war a lot throughout the rest of the season.
Yes. Yay!
It was probably reshoots, right?
Yes.
Yes, I assume so.
Thank you.
They gathered the cast, they put them on buses, they drove them all back to Albany to say
opera. I just imagine all sort of like, you know, doing the West Side Story thing, like just kind of like snapping, opera wars.
Some have triangles. Opera wars. All right. Around the Dial. I'm talking about The Curse, the new Showtime / Paramount Plus series, in which Asher and Whitney Siegel, played by Nathan Fielder and Emma Stone, they have moved from Santa Fe to Espanola, New Mexico, planning to build passive homes, which function like thermoses and thus theoretically don't require heating or cooling. To do this, they are buying and demolishing distressed properties to build their houses on the lots, but they're flippers who care and who are contributing to the community. And you can find out all about how they're building less environmentally impactful homes and mitigating the effects of their gentrification on flipanthropy, an unscripted show coming soon to HGTV, or at least that's the idea. When Asher screws over a little girl selling soda in a parking lot, she tells him that she has cursed him. It's possible she actually did, and maybe that will affect the show that they are trying to build as well. So we were made to watch the series finale of Nathan For You for this podcast. That was another Nathan Fielder show when our friend Will Leach pitched it for the canon. It was very much not for me. Neither was the one episode of The Rehearsal show that Fielder did for HBO a couple of years ago. So when I found out he had co-created a show with Benny Softee, who among other things wrote Uncut Gems, I was very scared to be made to watch this one as well. But here, Nathan Fielder is at least humiliating himself and the other people in any scene who may also be humiliated or doing so, having knowingly signed on to act in a piece of scripted entertainment. Therefore, the extreme cringiness of his other shows is absent here, and that makes it immediately more watchable for me. In the show, however, has a lot of ideas about colonization, appropriation, predatory real estate, fame, reality TV, influencers, and I don't think it has entirely thought through all of them. Even though it has 10 mostly hour-long episodes to deal with them, what I can say for sure is I was never bored. I think I liked it a little more than Alan did, but when I read his review, we agreed on more than I expected. So, Alan, we'll link your review as well, but go ahead and respond because you watched all of this as well.
I watched all of it. I'm recapping it for RollingStone.com every week. Like, I find parts of it absolutely fascinating, parts of it absolutely unbearable. Mm-hmm. I don't think it has any business being 10 hours, mm-hmm. and I'm really looking forward to seeing people who watch the whole thing respond to the finale, and that's all I should say about that. Look, like, I've never finished a Benny Softee movie. Like, I did not finish Uncut Gems. Wow. I did not finish Good Time. It's just sort of like my secondhand anxiety was too great. My secondhand mortification kept me from watching most of Nathan For You. This is a lot, but it's also a lot of things that they're doing with the relationship, with the stuff about reality TV, with the stuff about sort of phony wokeness and everything else is really interesting. And I just wish they were doing it in a more compact way, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll link to both of our reviews in the show notes. You can compare and contrast and be very aware when people say the show is more watchable than other Nathan Fielder stuff you've seen. That doesn't necessarily mean it's watchable full stop. It just means when you finish an episode, you probably won't want to die, which is how The Rehearsal made me feel.
It's like going into one of those stores that just sells hot sauce. You're like, this won't kill you, but it will put you in the hospital.
Yes, this is our mildest hot sauce. It will only make you cry.
All right, Alan, what do you have for us?
All right, so I'm going to just shamelessly plug the shit out of my new book, Welcome to the OC, The Oral History. It's coming out on November 28th. It features all three of my, you know, lovely hosts here because Television Without Pity turns out to be a part of the story of the OC. I wound up interviewing every single regular cast member from the show, extensively talked with Josh Schwartz and Stephanie Savage, the longtime showrunners of it. Most of the other key members of the creative team, guest stars like Colin Hanks, members of the bands featured on the show, like Ben Gibbard from Death Cab, Imogen Heap, Jem, a lot of others. So sort of trying to cover from soup to nuts, not only the story of this show, but like what it is like in general to make a TV show, what it was like to make a TV show in that particular moment in time in the mid-aughts, what it's like when suddenly you go from like this obscure guy who was working at a video store 2 years ago to one of the most famous people on the planet, like running from screaming fans, all of that. And then what happens when suddenly the overnight fame like gets yanked out from under you. So everyone was like shockingly candid, I felt. Like people said a lot of things I never imagined that they would. And I think it's, you know, obviously I wrote it, so I'm biased, but I think it's a good book. And I think the people who listen to this podcast would really enjoy it.
Love it. And we will link the pre-order information in our show notes, and everyone should get it. We will also include the picture of Murray, our dog, posing with it when it arrived at our house last week, because she really enjoyed it very much, Alan. She wanted me to let you know.
No, I mean, like, I was secretly targeting it primarily at the canine audience. So the fact that humans so far seem to like it as well, including several former OC Television to That Pity recappers who are also quoted in the book, seem pleased with what I'd done. So, but if the dog likes it, that's really all I'm about.
She didn't eat it. So there you go.
Give us one thing from the book that you were surprised to hear for our audience.
Both Adam Brody and everyone else are really candid about, like, how by the third season he just stopped trying. Like, literally, there's a storyline in season three where Seth Cohen gets addicted to pot, which is, I wouldn't say it's the worst thing they've ever done, because there's a lot of bad stuff in season three, but they wrote that storyline entirely because, like, Brody stopped trying, and they're like, we have to come up with some way to explain the fact that his on-screen persona is completely different and so low energy compared to what we've been doing previously. Caitlin gives him a joint and he just can't stop smoking.
That's like from Saved by the Bell. That's
gorgeous.
Fantastic.
Incredible.
All right. So pre-order. And, you know, I know you're saying on social that there is a madness to that. So if you could choose how people do it, you would say pre-order if you can, correct?
Rather yes, than and you don't have to buy it from Amazon. Pre-order it from wherever you would like. Yep. It's just the way the book industry runs now is, like, all booksellers decide how much they're going to order for when the book comes out based on how many people have pre-ordered it. So if there doesn't seem to be advanced demand, you know, then it's not going to sell much when it comes out. People won't be able to find it, buy it. So it's this whole weird, vicious cycle. So if you're curious at all, if you love the show, if you just love TV, if you love, you know, Television to That Pity, I think you'll like it. And please try to get it now if you can.
Awesome. All right, Sarah D. Bunting, what do you have for us?
Murder One.
Yeah.
My journey to finally tackling this long-standing member of the capital L list is kind of circuitous one. Long story short, I read Stephen Bochco's memoir, Truth is a Total Defense, over last weekend. You do not need to bother. Just Google Bochco memoir highlights, all those headlines from like 5 or 6 years ago. You already know the good stuff. Overall, it's the poorly copy edited self-aggrandizement tour you would expect. And kind of hilariously, Bog Iger's name is misspelled a couple different ways in the awkwardly brief cop rock section. But anyway, given the Bochco Milchness of it all, Murder One did seem appropriate for me to talk about this week, given our esteemed guest. Alan, did you watch this one, and what did you think of it
overall? Oh, I watched both seasons. Here's a funny story. So the first season is they're going to tell one mystery throughout the entire thing. And they're kind of having to make it up as they go along, because it's network TV in 1995, and you can't plan these things out. And eventually they come up with a solution, and the next year I'm visiting the Bochco offices because I was the NYPD Blue fanboy, and I run into one of the guys who had moved from Murder One to writing for NYPD Blue. I said, hey, I think you did a pretty good job there of, like, coming up with a solution that made sense. He's like, no, that was crap. Like, we were just tearing our hair out. We couldn't decide what to do, and this seemed the best of a bunch of bad options. But Daniel Benzali, I loved him. I thought that first season was really good. Then he left. The second season with LaPaglia was okay.
Well, my vague understanding slash memory of the show is basically what Alan just said. It was a prestige for a network take on a single case, as well as a sort of meta commentary, at least so Bochco was claiming in the memoir, on the O.J. Simpson case, which as of when Murder One premiered, still had not concluded and was the signal preoccupation of the entire culture. What everyone probably remembers about the show now, thanks to the memoir, is that Benzali was late to the set every day because he couldn't take a crap anywhere but in his own Malibu toilet, and it took him an hour to get to the set. And Bochco proposed all these different timelines and solutions, and when you drink your morning coffee, and Benzali was just hashtag actor bullshit about it.
Hashtag toilet strat.
Yeah, hashtag toilet strat. Like, team Benzali, honestly. But anyway, he was replaced by Anthony LaPaglia in season two, as Alan mentioned, and Bochco makes it out like that shit was why. And then he turns around and, like, slags LaPaglia for gaining 20 pounds in, like, 4 months and kind of implies that his expanding waistline was why the show got canceled. Like,
what?
Dude, calm your pants. Anyway, LaPaglia was stress eating, apparently. Gee, hard to imagine why in that supportive environment. Anyway, I think the actual problem with the show and the ratings was that it was kind of ahead of its time. I have watched a handful of episodes with my husband over the last few days, and it definitely seems like it's, you know, not the lead actor's fault. Murder One is in a lot of ways a 2010s show that's trapped in a mid-90s chassis, right down to Benzali himself. He is a non-standard leading man of the type you didn't always see back then, aside from, you know, Dennis Franz. But credit Bochco for generally trying to cast people who were attractive but credible looking, more so than most of the rest of TV. The show is serializing a single case a la Bosch, or actually Murder in the First, also Bochco and marginally more assured slash a better fit with its basic cable home. But I think networks weren't really ready for this idea. Some of them still don't know quite how to do it. So Murder One was also weaving in cases of the week. And while a lot of that material is well acted and literally everybody passes through the show at some point, like the second episode's case of the week is a kind of like commentary on racial profiling featuring Melrose's own Vanessa A. Williams and as her fiance, future The Practice star Steve Harris. It's pretty well done by the acting core. Steve Harris probably got cast in The Practice off of this, but Bochco had to juggle all of these things over a 22-episode order. Murder in the First, he got to just tell the 10-episode story his single case actually is, but in the 90s, you built the car that fit the existing road, so it's not a perfect show. It's not even a great show. The soundtrack is on brand in its intrusiveness. Bochco talks in his memoir about how, quote, haunting Mike Post's theme song work is. It isn't. It sounds as cheap as the credits look, which is really, really cheap. Like Xena spinoff made by a high school TV station cheap. It's shocking. There is some speechifying that if it weren't in the hands of extremely competent folks like Stanley Tucci or Patricia Clarkson would grind everything to a halt. And sometimes it still does that. Anyway, and everyone's so-called designer suits look, you know, like it's 1995, because it is. So I don't know if I recommend it exactly, but Dan and I keep eating them. It's kind of Pringles-y. It's very well acted. It seems a little bit kind of, you know, preachy, telling instead of showing, but for its time, it's less than that than you would expect from a Bochco product. Also, it's sort of hard to stream it for free, but we're going to keep going with it for a while and then probably stop before the LaPaglia stress eats all of Crafty era. Alan, is that a wise plan?
I mean, the LaPaglia season's fine. They do three cases instead of one, which I think on, you know, ultimately is better. I don't remember any of those cases, whereas I can tell you a lot of details still of the, you know, the Tucci, Jason, Gedrick, Benzali season, you know, despite it being almost 30 years now. So I think if you're fine if you stop after this.
Yeah. Speaking of things called Murder One, Dorothy Kilgallen's Murder One is a classic in the true crime genre in text. I carry that and so much other true crime from Aphrodite Jones to Zodiac at my true crime bookshop. That's Exhibit B Books. The buy three or more and get 20% off sale is on through Cyber Monday, which can we please stop calling it that? The cart will do the math. ExhibitBBooks.com.
All right, here's what's coming up this Friday on Extra Extra Hot. Great, it's Monarch Legacy of Monsters. If a decent show drops on Apple TV, does it make a sound?
That was my Godzilla impression.
According to my notes, special guest Godzuki. That was a joke. That's for three people there. All right, that is available to supporters. Go to extrahotgreat.com/club. And then right here on the next EHG Prime, the crown is back. So we must have back Heather Cox from the Fug Girls to talk all about that.
Heather Cox, quoted and welcome to the OC. Available for pre-order now.
Hey!
Thank you.
It is time for the Extra Hot Great Canon presenting this week. It's Mike. Take it away, Mike.
Over its three seasons, The Leftovers gave us many powerful and affecting moments and stories about how people deal with loss in a universe that doesn't make sense. Two Leftovers episodes have been justifiably inducted into the canon, centering on two out of three of the major characters that appeared in the full run of the show. It seems appropriate that an episode focusing on the third major character should take its place alongside those two. So I present today, for your consideration, Season 3, Episode 5, It's a Matt World. Yes, that one. Matt, played by Christopher Eccleston, is perhaps the least sympathetic of the main characters on The Leftovers. He's prickly, judgmental, narcissistic, stubborn. He's suffered hardships, but he views himself as a Job-like figure, and those hardships as tests of his faith. By the start of the third season, Matt believes that Kevin will be instrumental in something, Matt's unclear on exactly what, that will happen in the town of Jardin, Texas, on the anniversary of the sudden departure. Unfortunately, Kevin runs off to Australia, and this sets up the plot of the episode, which focuses on Matt's monomaniacal effort to bring Kevin home. What happens instead is an affecting, absurd voyage that forces Matt to reckon with how he has viewed God his whole life. This is the kind of episode that only The Leftovers could pull off, and it epitomizes the unique powers of the show. The world of The Leftovers is a broken world that has been glued back together, and Kintsugi style, it highlights where the cracks were by showing us people behaving in ways that seem outlandish but also weirdly plausible. In this case, most of the action takes place on a ferry to Melbourne that has been chartered by a sex cult based on a particularly fertile lion. They even have one of that lion's descendants in the hold of the ship. Also on the ferry is David Burton, played by Bill Camp, a man who claims to be God, but who mostly just reads Louis L'Amour novels and decks anyone who tries to talk to him. This is the show operating at a particularly bravura register, one that it used in smaller doses throughout its run, but that it puts front and center here. This is not just the show being bonkers for the sake of being bonkers, though, as amusing as that is. The heightened reality of the sex boat is of a piece with the biblical tone of the whole episode, telling as it does the story of a man whose life up to this point has been defined by religious certainties. The scenes of Matt walking through the ship as the orgies are in full swing visually evoke the idea of a prophet walking through Babylon. Kudos must also go to Eccleston's performance in this episode and his portrayal of a man whose arrogance and brashness hide some deeply buried insecurities. Initially, we see him in a compulsive mission from God mode, with perfect certainty about what he's doing and willingness to bulldoze through any opposition. But as the episode progresses, Matt starts to show signs of humility, and Eccleston makes these moments seem natural, so that by the end of the episode, we're convinced that Matt really has found some kind of peace. Eccleston's biggest scene is a remarkable two-hander with Bill Camp in the final act. Partway through the voyage, Matt is the only witness to David Burton throwing another passenger off of the ferry. In an effort to get some justice, Matt knocks out Burton, ties him to a wheelchair, and takes him down to the vehicle deck, where Chekhov's lion is being held in a cage. At this point, the attentive viewer knows that Bill Camp has appeared before on the show as a different character, playing Kevin's guide to the afterlife, an international assassin, so we're primed to the idea that something supernatural just might be going on. On its surface, Matt is offended by this man's sacrilege, but some deeply buried part of him doubts and wonders whether it's possible. And as our Job character finally has his conversation with God, we can see the crack in Matt's psyche slowly widen until it splits.
So you take no responsibility for your only son giving his life for the sins of mankind?
Seems a lot to ask somebody.
Then what do you take responsibility for? Dinosaurs? The Black Plague, Mount Everest, the Mona Lisa, the sudden departure?
Yeah, that was me.
The sudden departure was you.
Uh-huh.
Why?
Because I could.
You're gonna have to do better than that.
No, I don't.
You do.
Why?
Because there has to be a reason.
Why?
Everything in my life I've done for a reason.
Why?
To help people, to guide them, to ease their suffering, even though I've suffered myself. I sacrificed my happiness. I let my family abandon me.
Why?
For you!
But this brings me to another point about why The Leftovers was such a great show. You could never predict what it was going to do. This is a Matt POV episode, and his worldview and his righteous wrath make us think we're headed for a good versus evil showdown. Instead, we get something different when Burton tells Matt that he'll cure his cancer if Matt unties him.
Untie me.
Eccleston's face after this anticlimax conveys the quiet devastation of a deeply religious character losing their faith.
Ta-da. You're saved.
And yet The Leftovers isn't content to leave things here either, letting the viewer think that the whole thing was a sham and God doesn't exist. More on that later. Finally, here's my last point about why The Leftovers was such a great show. It was just really damn funny sometimes. I would love to show this episode to someone who bailed on the series after those first few bleak and depressing episodes of season one. They would see the opening credits accompanied by solemn chants and someone whispering in French and think that the show hadn't changed its tone a bit. And then the show takes us to a French nuclear submarine where a sailor strips naked, blasts Charles Aznavour's Je ne peux pas rentrer chez moi on the PA, knocks out his shipmates, uses some impressive calisthenics to unlock the nuclear launch button, closes his eyes, and presses the button. It's absurd and audacious, and it's another example of the sort of thing only this show could pull off. And there are other funny moments as well. For example, when Matt first confronts Burton on the ferry, Burton simply hands him a pre-printed card that says, "Yes, I am God," in block capitals on one side, and has a bunch of fine print on the other side, which Matt later reads to his traveling companions.
"I am the one true God. I go by many names, but Mr. Burton is fine. I will not take a photo with you. There was no Big Bang, just nothing then light.
Yes, I created you. No, I didn't create unicorns. Eve was not made from Adam's rib. It was his tibia. I asked Abraham to kill Isaac just to see if he'd do it. Yes, evolution is real, but it doesn't work how you think it does. I won the bronze medal for decathlon, and the one you can't remember is the hammer throw. No, I had nothing to do with the Crusades nor any type of genocide slash Holocaust. Can you believe this guy?"
But perhaps the finest moment of the episode, epitomizing all the best parts of The Leftovers, comes at the very end. As the ferry docks, Matt is conversing with his traveling companions and watching the passengers disembark. By sheer chance, the body of the man Burton murdered was discovered by a fishing boat, and the police are arriving to arrest Burton. And by another sheer chance, a couple of other passengers have decided to set the lion free right when the ship lands. Is this a higher power working in a mysterious way, or are these just random events in a random cosmos? In any event, what happens next is one of the most perfect and final scenes and final lines I've ever seen on television. As the police arrives, Burton makes a run for it. At that moment, the lion escapes and mauls Burton. And as the music swells and the police shoot the lion, Matt turns to face the camera, addresses his friends, and delivers a final line that is both straightforward and wonderfully ambiguous.
"That's the guy I was telling you about."
It's perfect and it's fully earned. This is a singular episode of a singular series, and I hope that you induct it into the canon.
Thank you so much, Mike. Alan, you chose this from our list of submissions. Please start us off.
I feel weird because one of the previous times I was on, we did another Leftovers canon submission. That may have even been mine. That was International Assassin. So Nora Durst is not in that one. She is not in this one. She's the best character on the show. Carrie Coon, now on Opera Wars, is like one of the great performers in the history of the medium. Mm-hmm. I fucking love this episode. This is, in many ways, despite the lack of Nora, this is kind of what I think of when I think of The Leftovers. The build-up to that final line, which is maybe the greatest line to end any episode of television ever, is spectacular. The scene that he talked about where Matt confronts Burton and they talk about faith and you sort of start to believe for a minute, maybe this is God, or no, maybe this is just an asshole, or maybe God is an asshole. Like, it could be any or all of these things. It's incredible. The fact that it opens with like this naked Frenchman hanging brain and then setting off a nuke. And then they're on a lion sex boat. And I just love using the phrase lion sex boat to get people who did not like the early episodes of the show to come back, and it inevitably works and they thank me later. This is spectacular. I could talk forever, but put it right into the canon right fucking now. Love it.
Also, that the French sailor is named P. Leon with a Y. So he's we see it on his uniform before he strips it off. So yeah, it's all tied together. I'll go next. Said it at the time, and I'll say it again. I'm like the outlier on International Assassin. The dream aspect of that episode, I think, lets you just light a lot of storytelling issues and sort of like do whatever you want in a way I find irritating. And this does the opposite, where it feels like a dream or a nightmare and sort of vacillates between the two, but it is all real as far as we know. And the question about what David Burton is sort of like left open, because he predicts that Matt is going to be convinced by him by the end of their conversation. And he's right. Like, Matt kind of is convinced by him, you know, in that confrontation that we heard a little bit of. I love the idea that someone read the real story of the real Frasier the Lion and was like, I have to make an episode. I have to work this into something that I write someday. And it was this, the careful, meticulous construction of it. Like, it feels, it never feels like too showy to me. It just, everything seems like it's happening for the most logical, illogical reason, including like Matt nearly getting molested by these sex cultists who ultimately do respect consent and are, you know, they don't go through with whatever they're going to do with him after he says Frasier's name in the forbidden time. Like, all of it, just the confluence of events that lead everybody to be here at this point. Like, the inevitability of it never feels contrived. And the final line, I mean, Alan and Mike are both right. It made me laugh the first time I watched it. It made me laugh when we watched it on Sunday. And it made me laugh again just now. It's like such a hilariously deadpan punchline on this incredibly complicated and thoughtful and weird episode that I fucking also love. So I'll throw it to Sarah. Sarah, your thoughts.
First of all, I'd just like to acknowledge the Chekhov's lion
line
from Mike. Chef's kiss. Well done. Mm-hmm. It's hard to imagine any circumstance in which we would not pass an episode in which God gets et by a big cat into the canon. But it was such a pleasure to rewatch this episode and to be reminded that this was, I think, the best work of Christopher Eccleston's career. And his work here is maybe the best of like a number of people's careers. He really rose to this character in a way that I loved to watch. And the tonal control of this show is absolutely on display here. They never, like Tara was saying, they never go too far. There's a scene when they're trying to get on this ferry, which has been reserved by the lion sex cult. And they're like, can't we just get a ride with you? And finally, they're like about to agree. And she's like, all right, tell me your filthiest joke. Yes. And Brenneman's Lori steps up and is like, okay, a panda. And then she's cut off. But like the way that that's written and performed is so precise, but not showy. And then Matt's sort of grim recitation of this joke that he comes up with. And then in the background of the shot, there's Brenneman as Lori. Like, Lori is disappointed that she doesn't get to do this joke. And it just brought me back to like my late uncle, who was a minister. Like, when there's sort of dead time during a wedding rehearsal, he'd be like, so the kangaroo says, joke's on you, I am the rabbi. Like, he would only say the punchlines of these jokes, and he had a list of like 40 of them. I miss that guy. I wonder if he wrote them down anywhere. Anyway, this show really, I think, I'm glad it was appreciated in its time, even by not that many people at one time. But to see a show this well made, like that it has faith in its own powers, is really a pleasure. You know, God got et by a lion, but also God's little card and the amount of what is on there that they tell you is another example of how perfectly controlled and just balanced this writing is. And then Matt bellowing at him like, you're denying paternity. It's so well done. And I did want to keep going and just like watch kind of from the beginning and see everything and resituate myself in this universe, and also see Carrie Coon, who was brilliant. But yeah, this was a really good, smart presentation and of a really good, smart show. And Frasier for president, that was really awesome. Dave, take us home.
I just have two things to add to what everybody has been saying, because I agree. One is, there's a line which I really enjoy, just describing somebody doesn't like as somebody who would have a misspelled tattoo and shits four times a day. Great. No notes.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, if you think Mrs. Davis came out of the blue and you're like, what the fuck? Here's a good bridge between whatever you've been watching and Mrs. Davis. This is like, has a lot of that energy to it. Mm-hmm. In a different context, yeah. Obviously, very different shows, same writer, but you get the sense of people enjoying what they did here and making it into this other beast later on, mm-hmm. with Mrs. Davis, because it has a lot of similar themes, but also just has that kinetic mad energy to it, Mrs. Davis does, that this episode demonstrates three or four times in a big way. So if you enjoyed Mrs. Davis and you haven't watched this, it's worth your time. I think you'll enjoy it. All right, let's put this to the official vote. Alan Sepinwall, what do you say? Canon worthy or not?
Yes.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Absolutely.
Sarah.
I agree.
Yes. All right, that means The Leftovers Season 3, Episode 5 is a Matt world. Yep, for Matt. You are hereby inducted into the extra hot great canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for the winner and loser of the week. Before we get into it, I just want to apologize. If you're hearing this on the recording, it's our dog. She has kennel cough, and I have to keep an eye on her. So apologies if you hear puffs of sadness. All right, who is our winner of the week?
Oh, puffs of sadness. This is not sad. Still, a Michael J. Fox movie, which I think Tara and I both talked about at some point on this podcast, is leading the Critics' Choice Documentary Awards with 5 wins, and well-deserved.
Loser of the week?
Loser of the week is the unnamed Nickelodeon pilot that Josie Tota put on blast this weekend at the Vulture Festival. Josie had been cast at age 12 to be in this pilot and then got fired for twerking. Now, I think anyone who has read Jeanette McCurdy's memoir knows Josie is certainly better off. I mean, Josie's in the cast of the Buccaneers, so certainly better off at the moment, but... yeah, maybe a blessing in disguise, but still a dark mark on whatever that show was for being anti-twerking. I don't care how old Josie Tota was at the time.
Speaking about the line, whatever that show was, do you know what time it is?
It's game time.
Oh, no. It's game time.
Yes.
All right, everybody, welcome back to Game Time. This is the 6th Game Time of the season. The scores are Tara with four already. Sarah has 0. Value guess, just 1. Today, we are playing Quantum Leaping 2 from Erica, who earns themselves an extra credit topic of their choosing, plus a free shirt from the Extra Hot Great Store at throughmethods.com. In this game, I will read you the description of a situation that Sam Beckett has just quantum leapt into.
Okay.
You tell me the TV character he is inhabiting for 3 points. If you need a hint, I will tell you the name of the show, after which the answer is worth 1 point. So big drop if you need that hint.
Okay.
Not all shows are scripted and none are repeated. You only get 1 guess.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
So I'll read you a description. You figure out who he's leapt into. Steel meal situation, please, Tara.
Thank you, Dave. Sarah D. Bunting is our steel meal leader with 8. I have 3. Value guests have Eric's meal, so just the 1, Alan. Sorry.
Okay, it's been a minute. Remind me when I can use the steel meal.
Well, first of all, shout it in a panic. Steel meal! After somebody has answered incorrectly, but before I give the correct answer, is your window of opportunity for the steel meal.
Thank you.
No problem. And I'll try to remember to pause this time. All right, let's throw it to Piggy to see our order today.
We will start with Tara.
All right. Tara, Sarah, Alan is our order. 27 questions. We got one Grossworth Equalizer Challenge Zone right in the middle of it to make things interesting. Are we ready to play Quantum Leaping 2?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
First question is to Tara. Tara, you materialize standing at a police station, staring at a dark-haired man who is staring eagerly back at you. Several seconds pass, and the man blurts out, "Like yeast!" Oh, boy. Who are we jumping into?
Oh.
You don't know.
Oh, no.
Ask for the hint. After several seconds pass, and the man you're watching blurts out, "Like yeast."
Yeah, I think I know the show, but I guess tell me the show.
Okay, the show is Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
I was wrong!
Like yeast!
Okay,
who has he jumped into?
Jake Peralta?
Jake Peralta is correct. Okay. Yes, as the one of the best cold opens ever.
The Diane Weist infection.
Yes. All right, Sarah D. Bunting. See if you can get 3 points with this one. You materialize as you're opening the front door of your apartment. Standing in front of you is a woman with a raw turkey on her head. As you watch, the woman starts to do a shimmy dance. Oh boy.
So you don't want the turkey lady's character.
Who are you just so left into? You are watching all those things I described.
I am your watching POV. All those things, but who walked in the door? I guess I have a bunch of choices, and I choose Rachel Green.
Incorrect. We were looking for Tara
Chandler.
Chandler Bing. Yes, that's Monica with the turkey on her head.
R.I.P.
All right, Alan, here is your first question. No 3-point answers yet. You materialize dressed for a funeral, standing in the sanctuary of an enormous church that is empty except for you. It is pouring rain outside, and there is a crushed cigarette under your foot. Oh, boy.
I am Josiah Bartlett, and I am cursing in Latin.
You are correct, and that is our 3-point answer, numero uno.
Cool guy.
You should probably say the show's, too. That's The West Wing.
West Wing. Tara.
Yes.
You materialize in a Civil War-era farmhouse, kneeling next to a bed that has screaming coming from underneath it. The man kneeling next to you rolls a platform out from under the bed, revealing a woman with no arms, no legs, and a really upsetting face. Oh, boy.
Well, that's The X-Files, the best episode of The X-Files, in my opinion, home. But whose body am I in? I guess I'll say Fox Mulder.
You are incorrect.
Steel Mill.
Yeah. Steel Mill from Alan.
Dana Scully.
Dana Scully is, in fact, correct. All right, so that's a 3-point steal from Alan because that was not a hint. That
now you're useful. Out of steel meal, so.
Yeah, but that's.
But look, if I was going to get 3 points, that
that's
was a gimme.
Right. Correct.
Alan, you're using steel meals correctly.
Mm-hmm.
If you know you're going to get the 3 points, use it. You only
for
got
sure.
One.
Yes. Mwah!
I doff my cap to user. All right, Sarah D. Bunting. You materialize in a sunny park standing next to a woman with blonde hair. A woman with dark hair stands in front of you, and she looks furious. As you stand there, she spits. I hate you both. Never talk to me again. Oh, boy.
Oh, boy. I am Brenda Walsh, stomping off, and how I get home, who knows. Beverly Hills 90210.
You
Brenda Walsh.
Dylan McKay.
No,
oh, no,
you
I'm,
see
I'm
both of the
looking
women.
At, okay.
Yeah,
shit. Okay, someone should steal it.
Well, it's too late. I already gave the answer. Alan Sepal, back to you. You materialize standing on a curb covered in blood and holding a pair of hands that are not attached to a person. There is a man standing by at the edge of a huge pool of gore. As you watch, he mutters that he can't stop and takes off running at superhuman speed. Oh boy.
Oh God, I'm... His name is Huey from The Boys?
Huey Campbell, correct.
Nice pull.
All right.
Nicely done. Tara.
Yes.
You materialize walking next to a line of dumpsters set out next to a very large building, and burning embers are falling all around you. You look up to see something very large and very on fire falling towards you. Oh, boy.
I think I'm Rocket Romano in ER about to get squished by a helicopter.
You are correct.
Bless.
Sarah D. Bunting. You materialize in a cave. Behind you are two young women in bikinis, and in front of you are two humans and a robot. The robot is holding a bottle cap and demanding that you party with them. Oh boy.
Was this a canon episode? I forget.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I need the hint.
The show is Futurama. It doesn't help, but I'm going to give you an extra hint because I feel sorry for you because you got this one. Not a main character.
Oh.
Okay, that doesn't really help either, but why not? I'll name my favorite character I do remember, Zoidberg.
That is incorrect. We were looking for Slurms McKenzie. Slurms McKenzie. Alan, you materialize in front of a dais and a beautiful woman is screaming at you. Behind the woman, three people are seated at a long table and looking at you critically. A cluster of young women are standing off to the side and some of them are crying. Oh boy.
Yeah, I need the hint for this one.
All right. The show is America's Next Top Model.
Am I Tyra Banks?
You're not.
No. What was her name?
Steel Meal.
Steel Meal from Sarah for 1 point.
Her name was Tiffany.
Tiffany is correct.
It was Tiffany.
Nice.
I really needed a point, guys. I have one.
Tara.
Yep.
You materialize next to a car with its passenger side door open, parked in the middle of the woods. A young woman is crying and crawling away from you, and you are pointing a gun at her. Oh, boy.
Oh, no. Am I Tony Soprano? Shit.
Steel Meal.
Steel Meal. Yep. She's rich with steel meals, and she's using them. Who are we talking about?
Yeah. Sure I am. That is Silvio Dante.
Yes, from The Sopranos. 3 point steel meal. And now is your full question, sir. You materialize in an old-fashioned armchair sitting across from a young man on an equally old-fashioned sofa. In front of you is an extremely large egg in an elaborate gold cup. Its shell has been broken and your fingers are covered in egg whites. Oh boy.
Oh, I hope I'm Teddy Perkins.
You are Teddy Perkins from Atlanta. Yes. 3 points. To Alan, you materialize standing in the doorway of a well-appointed office looking into a plain but pleasant lobby. You see a young blonde woman sitting on a couch staring at the wall in front of her on which are painted 4 words in cheerful green paint. Oh boy.
I am Michael.
You are Michael from?
The Good Place.
The Good Place. Correct. Tara.
Yep.
Everybody's got one more question before we hit our score break.
Okay.
This is yours.
Mm-hmm.
You materialize in a large, airy tent next to an angry Scottish man holding a cookie sheet that holds what looks to be a large chunk of melting ice cream. As you watch, he opens a garbage can and drops the chunk into it, then storms away. Oh, boy.
Oh, my God. What's the show?
The show is The Great British Bake Off.
Oh,
You materialize next to this angry Scottish man.
Yeah. I mean, presumably I'm one of the bakers, but I don't know which one. So I don't know.
You are either Sue or Mel.
Oh, okay.
Sarah D. Bunting?
Yeah.
You get this, I'm just going to give you the game. You materialize at the controls of a small spacecraft.
Space!
That is going faster than you could possibly imagine. Behind you lies an unconscious woman in a red and black uniform. When you look at your reflection in the control panel, you see that you appear to be turning into some sort of amphibious creature. Oh boy.
Oh boy.
Hint.
The show is Star Trek Voyager.
It's so bad.
It's so bad.
Oh, this was a show we talked about for either the canon or the Nodak.
Janeway.
Not Janeway. The answer we're looking for, Tom Paris. Tom Paris turns into a salamander or something like that.
No, good for him.
All right, Alan, we'll take us into our score break. You materialize wearing a lovely evening gown standing next to a wall made out of rectangular panels. Some of the panels begin to light up and make a chiming sound, and you instinctively begin clapping. Oh, boy.
I'm Vanna White.
You are Vanna White. Yes. Nicely done.
Who amongst us?
All right, Tara. Let's get them scores.
Oh boy, it's not close. Alan has 15, Sarah has 7, I have 4.
All right, but Tara, that means you are in the Grossworth Equalizer Challenge Zone.
Okay.
You know, I got all those boxes of questions. Which one do you want it from?
I'll take the most recent actual Trivial Pursuit game, not that weird off-brand one that you found at Goodwill.
Damn. All right.
Not falling for that.
So you want the 90s?
Yes. Yes. I'll take 90s, please.
All right. The 90s set has the added benefit of each card is all about one year. So I'll read you the TV questions as I come across them in this pile of cards.
Okay.
What quirky TV series featured an FBI agent who liked his coffee black as the midnight without moonlight?
Twin Peaks?
Twin Peaks is correct. That was 1990, by the way. Helpful hint after the fact. Also from 1990.
Yep.
What TV show shot Joel and the bots into endless orbit on the satellite of love?
Mystery Science Theater 3000.
You are correct. That's 2 out of 2. We're now in 1999.
Okay.
What PBS show did William F. Buckley end after 33 years noting, I just as soon not die on stage?
Oh. It's not this, but I can't think of what it is. Crossfire. It's not
Ooh,
that.
Ooh, very close. Firing line.
Fuck.
All right. We only need one more for your 3 points.
Okay.
Gobble up here.
Yep.
1992. What teenaged vixen did Alyssa Milano, Drew Barrymore, and Nicole Parker all portray in TV movies?
Oh, no. Amy Fisher. Fuck. I was like, Mary Jo Buttafuoco. No, it wasn't her.
You now have 3 points. 3 extra points, Tara. So quickly, update scores for everybody listening home.
Wee. All right. Well, now Sarah and I are tied with 7 points each. Alan still in the lead with 15.
Oh, hey. Still some game left. Let's get back to it. Tara Ariano, your next question. Remember, you are materializing into a character. Name the character. Ask for the show if you need a hint.
Okay.
You materialize in a clearing in the woods, holding a pointer in your hand. Next to you is a chalkboard on wheels on which is taped a map of Tibet. 4 people sit in folding chairs watching you expectantly, and as one, they all lean forward. Oh boy.
Can I get the show, please?
The show is Twin Peaks. You are...
Dale Cooper?
You are Dale Cooper.
Okay. Wow. Yep.
All right. This is for Sarah. Question 17.
It's pretty
cool. Well, it's pretty cool.
You materialize in a middle school auditorium dressed as an elephant and standing on a strange contraption. Across the room, a small girl wearing bunny ears yells, "Hit it!" into a walkie-talkie, and all around you, the strange contraption starts to make sounds like electricity. Oh, boy.
Oh, my God. I need a hint, please.
The show is Bob's Burgers.
But you're not the bunny ears girl. She's in the audience.
Right, you're not the bunny ears. Am I Jean?
Nope.
Oh, no,
the other one?
Gina.
I thought it was Gene, too.
I would have said Gene, yeah.
Gene does
he's
the
Thomas
music.
Thomas Edison, that's right.
And yes.
Gina's the elephant. Alan, you materialize in a park with a trace of a grin on your face. The somber-looking man standing next to you asks, "Where do you think we are?" When you look around, you see you're not in a park. You're in a cemetery. Oh, boy.
I'm Dr. Cox.
You are Dr.
From
Cox
Scrubs.
From Scrubs, correct. This is question. It is for Tara.
Yep.
You materialize in a dark, cramped space, barely able to move, surrounded on all sides by what feels like plexiglass. Suddenly, you hear a cracking sound, and before you know it, ants are crawling all over you. Oh, boy.
I mean, I'm not going to win, so I guess I might as well just guess. Am I Nick Stokes?
You are Nick Stokes
you
from
sure
CSI
are.
In the famous Tarantino episode. Sarah D. Bunting, you materialize just as a wealthy-looking man is throwing a basketball at you. After you catch it, a hatch opens in the top of it, and oddly enough, a monkey crawls out of it and gives you a hug. Oh, boy, and also aw.
Aw, boy. Am I Captain
Kragan?
You are, yes. Law and Order SVU.
Yep.
I forgot that question was in there when I mentioned it earlier in the chat. Alan, yes. You materialize in a cage in what appears to be a high school library. You are wearing a fuzzy sweater and tights. A teenage girl in a sparkly silver dress is lecturing you on the ethics of boyfriend stealing, and for some reason, your eyes are drawn to her neck. Your stomach growls in hunger. Oh boy.
I am Evil Willow from Buffy.
I'll take that. Yep. Vampire Willow, Evil Willow from Buffy. Tara.
Yep.
You materialize about to enter a dining room where a group of people are getting ready to eat a large meal. Just as you start to enter the room, a woman dressed as a pilgrim comes in from another room and throws a pie at one of the men. The man ducks and the pie hits you in the face instead. Oh boy.
Oh.
I'm Vera Peterson from Cheers.
You are.
So many canon scenes in here today.
Back to Sarah. You materialize on a spaceship looking at a view screen.
Space.
Yeah.
Space.
On the screen is a crazy-haired man wearing a green lab coat and holding up a film canister in a threatening manner. For some reason, a robot that looks like a gumball machine is hovering next to you, and all of a sudden, a siren starts blaring. Oh boy.
Oh boy, this just came up in this equalizer zone.
Oh boy. And I'm going to let you know three possible answers. Do you know the show?
I think it's... Oh, so it's three possible answers? All right, then that confirms that my belief that it is Mystery Science Theater. And so let's go with Top Servo. God damn it.
Mike, okay. Joel, or Crow were your possible answers. Damn.
All right, well.
All right. That was a heartbreaker. All right, yeah, this is for Alan.
Dylan McKay, ditto.
You materialize on a stage wearing a tight black dress and very high heels, surrounded by a screaming, cheering audience. Whitney Houston, so emotional, is blasting all around you. There is another performer on stage with you, and as you watch, she slowly pulls a long red wig off her head, showering the stage in rose petals. Oh boy.
I am going to need a hint for this one.
Wow. The show is RuPaul's Drag Race, Alan.
Yeah, that's the. I'm way out of my element here. I'm just going to say RuPaul.
It's not. Tara, do you know who this is?
I only know who the rose petal is. I forget who the opponent was.
Shay Cooley.
Right. Sasha Velour is the one pulling the wig off.
All right. Everybody has one question left. Make it count.
Okay.
Tara.
Yep.
You materialize as you're being helped off the ground in front of a hospital, your head throbbing. You hear a voice issuing from the cell phone in your hand and look up to see a man in a black coat standing on the edge of the roof. The man tosses his own phone aside, tumbles forward, plummeting off the roof. Oh boy.
Am I Watson from Sherlock?
You are, yes. Nicely
sussed. Nice pull.
Good.
Sarah, you materialize on stage in some kind of sporting facility with a microphone in your hand. There's a man standing behind you singing, and all of a sudden, you feel a slight breeze on a sensitive area of your chest. Oh boy.
Oh my God.
Oh God.
It's kind of dark, actually.
Oh man.
I think I'm Janet Jackson.
You are Janet Jackson from Super Bowl 38.
Miss Jackson, if you're nasty.
Wow.
Which also comes up in Welcome to the OC. I'm just going to keep shamelessly plugging this thing.
Do it.
How so?
That's the part of the reason why Olivia Wilde had to be written off the show is the Janet Jackson backlash.
Wow.
Then caused Fox to like be like, you cannot have this lesbian teenage relationship on your teenage soap.
Right. Jeez. Okay.
That seems sensible.
Yeah, related.
All right, Alan, last question. You materialize in what looks like a science classroom. In front of you is an unconscious man with a bleeding stump where his hand used to be and a ticking device that sure looks like a bomb. Oh, and there's an axe in your hand. Oh, boy.
I'm going to need a hint.
The show is 24.
Am I Jack Bauer?
You are Jack Bauer, yes. And that's good for one final point. Let's get them scores.
Oh, boy.
I think in the end, we all performed respectably. Sarah has 13. I have 17. Alan is our victor with 22.
Whoa. Yeah. It's a blow, baby. Nicely done, Alan.
Valued guest. Valued guest.
Look, I'm just going to view this as continued karma for you guys being so mean about the time that I tried to submit the Quantum Leap episode
where he goes that.
To himself as look, a teenager. So, okay, yes, suck it.
Follow up as we play the outro music. We started watching Quantum Leap, and we eventually got to your canon submission. And everybody's like, well, when you get there, having watched all the previous episodes, you're going to be like, all right, this is earned. You feel bad for him. You feel, nope. Still corny, Alan. Sorry.
Oh, hearts of stone. Yep. Hearts of stone.
That's my trademark. All right, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We travel down under the hotbed that is American-Australian geopolitical relations to discuss NCIS Sydney navally before our day celebrated the one thing that brings Sydney and America together, the Opera Wars. We went around the dial with stops at The Curse, The OC, Alan's new book, which you should pre-order now,
hell yeah,
and Murder One. Mike successfully and kinda navally got The Leftovers. It's a Matt world into the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week. And Alan was the winner of this week's Game Time from Erica. Next up, it's Monarch Legacy of Monsters on Extra Extra Hot Great. And come back here next week for The Crown on EHG Prime. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
it'd be twice as good with half the wankas.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Like God, I only won the bronze.
And Alan Steppenwall.
Poop deck.
Yeah. Thanks for listening. Why is this so funny? We'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
Sorry you have to go through that.
I'm not so sure you are.
All right, stop that recording.
See, Dave, it's funny because it has poop at the start of the word.
I know the answer.